Therapy on the Cutting Edge, a podcast for therapists who want to be up to date on the latest advances in the field of psychotherapy. I'm your host, Dr. Keith Sutton, a psychologist in the San Francisco Bay Area and the director of the Institute for the Advancement of Psychotherapy. At the Institute for the Advancement of Psychotherapy, we provide training in evidence-based models, including family systems, cognitive behavioral therapy, emotionally focused couples therapy, eye movement desensitization reprocessing, motivational interviewing, and other approaches through live in-person and online trainings, on-demand trainings, consultation groups, and one-way mirror trainings. We also have therapists throughout the Bay Area and California providing treatment through our six specialty centers, each grounded in an evidence-based approach. With our lifespan centers, Center for Children and Center for Adolescents, where all the therapists are working systemically, our Center for Couples, where all the therapists are using emotionally focused couples therapy, and our specialty issue centers, our Center for Anxiety, where all the therapists are using CBT and EMDR for trauma, and our Center for ADHD and Oppositional and Conduct Disorder Clinic, where we're integrating those four approaches. In the Institute, we have our licensed, experienced therapists, and for those in financial need, we have an associated nonprofit, Bay Area Community Counseling, where clients can work with associates, psych assistants, and licensed clinicians who are developing their abilities and expertise. Additionally, as part of our nonprofit, we also have the Family Institute of Berkeley, where we provide treatment, training, and one-way mirror trainings in family systems. To learn more about trainings, treatment, and employment opportunities, please go to sfiap.com. And to support our nonprofit, you can go to sf-bacc.org to donate today to support access to therapy for those in financial need, as well as training in evidence-based treatment. BACC is a 501c3 nonprofit, so all donations are tax deductible. Today, I'll be speaking with Jeff Greenwald, marriage and family therapist, who is a world champion athlete, licensed psychotherapist, best-selling author, and one of the world's leading mental coaches for athletes. With over 25 years of experience helping youth, college, and professional competitors thrive under pressure, Jeff brings a rare blend of elite performance, insight, and clinical expertise to his work. He is the author of the international bestseller, The Best Tennis of Your Life, which has sold over 80,000 copies worldwide, and the new book, The Mental Edge for Young Athletes, a groundbreaking guide for building confidence, emotional resilience, and a stronger mindset in sports and life. Jeff has worked with athletes across every major sport and consulted for national teams, Fortune 500 leaders, top junior academies, and competitive athletes at all levels of sport. He is a two-time ITF World Champion and was inducted into the Northern California Tennis Hall of Fame in 2019 for his contribution in the field of sports psychology and success as a world-ranked tennis player. Through his writing, coaching, and speaking, Jeff empowers athletes and their families to navigate the mental game with clarity, courage, and lasting confidence. Let's listen to the interview. Well, hi, Jeff. Welcome. Thanks for joining.
Great to be here, Keith. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Definitely. So, I was interested in learning more about sports psychology. I was working with a client recently and just interested in working with some folks in that area. And you came to mind as I had done some consultation with you in the past. You're here in Marin County in the San Francisco Bay Area working with adolescents and I think adults and young adults around sports. And also, I would love to hear your thoughts and learn more about kind of your perspective on the work that you've been doing. And I've also know you've written some books. So I would love to learn more about it. But first, I always like to start off with, you know, finding out about how you got into this work and kind of the evolution of your thinking of the approaches that you bring to this work.
Yeah, it's interesting to go back for all of us, right, to go back and see the journey forward. In 2002, I was licensed mm-hmm. as an MFT. And at the time I was doing, sports psychology work and clinical. So it was 50-50, I would say, for many, many years, probably, 10 to 15 years of both. But more and more the space of sports and athletics and youth was growing and growing. And, you know, where we are now is quite remarkable from 1997 when I started, opened up Mental Edge, but also was doing the clinical work. And now in 2025, how mental coaching and mindset coaching and so forth has all now been really normalized with all the athletes coming out, COVID and post-COVID, really,
Sure.
opening up about their challenges clinically and otherwise, working with a sports psychologist or working with a therapist, psychologist. So it's been, I've liked the variety, and I've early days just really loved working with families and get the have the 10, 12-year-old boy baseball player coming in and just distraught and anxious, and both parents really, of course, with youth sports, how it is, they're so involved and care so much and so much passion, the parents, and that not really understanding the impact, right, on the kids, and seeing that. So I worked a lot, with families in that regard, and tried to educate the parents. And then, just over the last, I'd say, 5 years, moved more into almost exclusive sports psychology. And we can talk about the sort of convergence, of clinical and where does it
Sure.
end and where does sports psychology begin, or but so it's and now I'm kind of wanting to come full circle again and do some more family work, and it's a little more it's rich, and and the need is so is really there for that help, that support,
Sure.
with the craze of college, competitive nature of getting into a good college, and all of that, and the fear of failure. And now we have social media, so there's all, we can talk more about sort of how things
Sure.
evolved, not necessarily in a good way, unfortunately.
Definitely. Okay, wonderful. Yeah, tell me a little bit about the difference between the clinical and the sports psychology, or even kind of what approaches are being kind of used or utilized in this work.
Yeah, I mean, so the peak performance enhancement work, is really, there is CBT in there for sure, obviously. I mean, helping kids, parents, reframe and find new perspectives, et cetera, which is a more of a challenge now. I'm finding 5 years ago it was not as big of a push, and to really move the needle on focusing on the process and mastery over outcome, which has become this huge elephant,
Sure.
winning, will we win, and everything else that's on it. So the clinical aspect really, is where we're getting, deeper into that anxiety, right, and the relationships and at home and so forth. And performance enhancement work, is dealing with focus and different focusing styles. People don't really know, if you're not really in the field, the dimensions of focus as it relates to sports performance, and kids' focusing styles. So that's kind of an interesting aspect of sports psychology, and which is kind of beyond the CBT aspect. But also, I've worked with ACT for many, many years. I actually thought 15 years ago, I think I started with a motivational interviewing and bringing, what I was doing, and it was really fun actually, was taking some of the, well, a lot of what we know in motivational interviewing, ACT, CBT, a little bit of somatic work, and sort of morphing that, applying it with athletes and coaches as well, and how coaches can help communicate in a different way. So the motivational interviewing was really, really effective. And but yeah, so obviously the clinical aspect is when they can't really utilize the tools,
Sure.
they're just stuck and so forth. Yeah, so
Well, tell me about the different styles of focus or so on. That's interesting. I haven't heard of that.
yeah, well, so and it's an assessment that I've used for many, many years, that the Olympic Training Center had used, and I think still probably does. And it's there's these four dimensions of focus. There's sort of an internal, narrow internal focus, a narrow external, and then we have a broad internal and a broad external. So there's sort of different dimensions, and a narrow external is, you're focused on the ball. simple. It's very, very narrow. But a lot of athletes are in their head, they're thinking about different things, technique, strategy, but also, of course, outside of that performance realm, they're thinking of what are my parents going to say on the car ride home, which is the deadly time for everybody. But
So is that like the broad, so is that like the narrow external and like the broad, the narrow internal kind of thinking about like, oh, the pressure or so on, or how I'm feeling or what's going on, and
so if
then
you want specifically, yeah, so the narrow internal would be your thinking, don't lose. You're really on a thought, and but it can also be positive. You're regulating, you're taking a deep breath, and so you're internal, very specific. The broad internal would be more strategic. You're thinking, should I, pass more? Should I take the shot? You're internally evaluating, what does coach want me to do? So that's more of a broad, not so narrow.
Like how kind of you and the team are working together or so on,
So
or in
you'd be sort
strategy.
of a lot of overthinkers. So you have kids who, and then you just have the regulation challenge, right? Where they just blow up and all that. The overthinkers and smart, really bright kids tend to just get in their own way, right? And so it's just helping them understand these dimensions that they have a choice. So in my book, The Mental Edge for Young Athletes that I just released, I talk about using a remote, giving kids a remote control, essentially, which they like, right? Like that they have, that we're putting the buttons on together, but they are the ones who have to press the button and to change the channel, so to speak, or shift their focusing style. Because as like giving kids agency and having them feel empowered to make those changes, internally or otherwise. And the parent, because the parents are very involved and all of that. So we could talk forever about just that agency aspect, which is so important.
And maybe you can talk a little bit about that, because I was mentioning as we were chatting before we started this, an often piece that comes up for many families, or even just in my with my own kids or other people that I know of kids, is around, the kids kind of want to be like, oh, I don't want to do soccer anymore or something like that, or right, and kind of figuring out like, do we press and have them keep going with this? Do we say, okay, like you can, end, or I think that's sometimes a difficult place to figure out for parents, is this something that would be good to encourage them to persist and not leave versus actually this is something that they're just not enjoying. This is something that they used to enjoy, but now they don't anymore. They've developed in different ways or so on.
No, you're bringing up a kind of a crucial sort of challenge in the family, because kids will say, I'm going to quit. They have a bad game, bad match, and they I'm quitting, and then that's more they're emoting and they're and so on, and that's we it's best to roll with that. Yeah, at first, it's they're anxious, they don't know how to regulate, they're worrying all the time, fear of failure, and all these things. So the anxiety is really dominating that, and that's really more the often contributor there, in terms of I want to quit and I don't want to, experience this and dread the games and all that. And so, that being said, the pressure kids feel these days is big, and as we said, social media is all, they see themselves are exposed. So helping parents recognize their impact is important. And often I find that they are open to hearing about giving kids space and not attacking them after they, right after the game and talking about it and coaching them and giving them tips and all this stuff. And so it's helping parents, step back, because if what happens is parents, feel obligated and feel pressure too, right? With college and all the money they're spending and hiring pitching coaches and you name it. So it's a big pressure cooker. And And so helping them, let their kids have some space and validate them, and don't try to rush in and fix, all those approaches that are so important. So, because if you're on the other side of it, and kids are, the parents are more interested and engaged on it than the kids are, that's not where you
Sure.
want to be with this whole thing,
Yeah,
So
yeah.
it's really challenging, but letting kids have more space with it. But if they say, "I want to quit," and they're really dreading games and the whole thing, it's just finding out what's going on. It's probably anxiety, maybe the coach. The coaches can be sometimes
Oh,
just
yeah.
really negative, critical, domineering, and they're just and frankly, they're it's kind of emotional abuse. It's as
Yeah,
well.
yeah.
Happens all the time. So it's really trying to find out what your kids, what do they feel, and validate them, and don't just rush in, of course, and try to solve it and t fix it. And so,
Sure. So, kind of giving that space and trying to understand what might be going on, or so on, and then kind of figuring out, yeah, how you might address those, or really to help kind of evaluate what might be the best course of action.
right, because the kids don't have the tools, right? So it's they don't have options. And so when their teammates are giving them a little, hard time because they had, missed a shot, et cetera. So there's sort of the
Yeah.
anxiety of the teammates, and maybe not relationally is tough. And the coach, as I said, and then the parents are kind of hovering, and it just quickly becomes a pressure cooker that's no fun anymore. And that's the thing. I think it's like about 70% of kids by 16 are quitting sports.
Oh, wow.
They're quitting, and because it's not fun anymore.
Yeah.
And a lot of, and I work with a lot of tennis players too, and it's become a job, sadly. That they're starting out at eight, six, eight, and it's work, and they're the joy. You just don't see the joy.
Yeah.
You don't see the fun, and coaches are. It's really gotten crazy a bit.
Yeah, definitely. What was that that movie, King Richard, about the Serena and Venus's family? Like, oh my gosh, I'm really falling down as a parent here. It's working, although I know they had a lot of issues. But that, idea of like how hard should the parent be working on getting this thing to happen or not, or right? And I know in the value in that situation was, helping with their financial situation and such. But yeah, really also, I guess, looking at the motivations too of, is this something the kid wants? Is this something the parent's pushing for? Is this something, right? Parents sometimes reliving their own youth through their kids or
For
such.
sure, for sure. And also, the temperament of the kid is very important, right? So you assess, they're obviously introverted, extroverted, but there's, what's the profile? Highly sensitive, highly intense kids who are, they really need tools to manage that. And that's a big, that's an opportunity. I see it as an opportunity mostly. So when kids are in that place, is they often just, like as I said, don't have tools, nor do the parents. So educating them, which again, why I wrote this book, it's a super nuanced of these moments. I try to capture, in real time, the conversations that I've had with parents and kids and so forth. And but assessing the temperament, if kids are not that athletic really, and they're more they have a propensity for art or other things. So it's not pushing that boulder up the hill may not be the best thing. So yeah, I think it's important for parents to really step back and evaluate their child and their temperament. And the assessment I have also kind of assesses the rigidity and flexibility, and so forth, so that's an
Definitely.
aspect of it,
Yeah. And I'm curious, I was actually one of the other reasons that made me think about doing an interview on this was because I was working with a kid in a family. And he was very good at sports. He was in fifth grade or going into fifth grade. And one of the things he really struggled with was when he did mess up or it didn't quite go the way he wanted, even though he was oftentimes doing much better than some of the other kids in the situation, whether it be ski team or baseball or whatever it might be, he just gets so hard on himself and really be beating himself up. And of course, we use the cognitive behavioral therapy pieces. But I was kind of curious about, because with sports, you are not going to win 100% of the time, right? Even a good batting average is just, hitting the ball one out of three times or so on. So I was just curious if there is not a boilerplate, but like kind of standard, pieces that we bring in the way that kids can think about when things don't go the way they're hoping, or they're not performing as well as they are, or they lose the game or so on, because that is inherent within the sports.
100%, and that this is an aspect, Keith, that's gotten, even worse over the past, decade, really. The perfectionism and, no room for error, and so you do often find critical parents who are over, teaching their kids, and so it can be, but they're also can be hardwired with anxiety, et cetera, right? But that perfection is, I think that, naming it, right, is really important. And so when perfectionism hits, a little bit of externalization is useful, right? When it hits, and having that conversation, and with young kids, it works pretty well. And so it's sort of, you're on a team together, and when that hits, because, and of course, the stats are, now we have information. So using data, I mean, if you win 55% of the points in tennis, in a tennis match, or over the course of a year, just 55%, you're number one in the world. If you win, believe it or not, if you win just over half the points, you win the match. And what, but as we know, kids' amygdala is just totally activated, and they're out there, and it's emotional, and they just, so all rationale goes out the window. But with consistency, and then having a tool like, deep diaphragmatic breathing, and really, using that, generalizing that, using it in the classroom, and getting, just teaching them something even simple like that, and explaining it so they understand it. But finding a tool that can help them, is because their amygdala is just, boom, it's on fire. And I talk about the, fire extinguisher, and they, a lot of analogies are helpful. Remote control, fire extinguisher, to give them agency again, right? And now they feel, that they have a place to go to in these moments,
Some like locus of control rather
100%.
than going out of
Exactly.
control.
Exactly. Exactly. That's a huge one. And so, these tools by themselves, if not contextualized and sort of worked with some of the externalization, and this is the art and the science of it, right? How to sort of teach it, deliver it, and have some accountability on using it. And so I have, post-game reflection and a little bit of journaling. I try to encourage them, and coming back to the call with me, or our meeting, and how did it go? And how did you use that, and give me specific examples.
Is there any, yeah, is there any guidance around the post-game reflection? Is there like any structure to that, or is it just reflecting on what went well or didn't go well?
And specifically related to the tools that you're teaching, and how, what got in the way of using it, if they did or didn't use that tool, and just, whole, sort of ref, ex, exploring that with them, those questions, because often too, they'll say, let's say they had a mediocre game. They're gonna focus, it was the worst game of their life, and and they're gonna focus on the negative. And so helping them also pull out the positives, and validating that, and get, and kids, we're in a position where we're not the parent, right? So that if we validate them, and specifically, and it's received because they're working with us, then it can go a long way, and you can get some real momentum once they start using it. Can be a game changer, life changer, because they are using these tools in the context of really pressure moments. So,
Definitely.
parent, that's really, I think, an appeal, because these tools, skills generalize obviously to their life,
Of course, definitely. Yeah, and I was thinking too, like in this case that I was talking about, the parents fortunately weren't pressure and so on, were very supportive. But you were mentioning motivational interviewing. You know, the way I kind of think about it too, sometimes with the cognitive behavioral therapy, you know, we all have this ambivalence, and sometimes as a parent, as they're trying to help out, the kid says, "Oh, I had a horrible game," and the parent says, "Hey, but what about this? You did this, you did that, right?" And the kid says, "Yes, but," and unknowingly, as the parents trying to be supportive, they're sometimes eliciting that other side of the ambivalence.
Right.
And so
Yeah, and yeah, that's why it's really an underutilized skill. I think we know that as therapists, right? That and I think even more now because everybody's sort of a bit hijacked, I think. With social media or just in technology, things are moving really fast, and then you have the coach and the getting on the team and playing it's just it's a lot. And so yeah, the tools, the regulation tools, and like you said, validating them, the kids, and not rushing to the answer and just exploring it and just holding the moment just a little bit, it reduces the defensiveness of the kids, right? They don't feel the need to then go more extreme on something because so that part has you know a very it's been a big part of my work over the years is trying to help parents show up in the best way, when the kids show anxiety to normalize it and not get all worked up themselves and have
Well, I was
other
going to
things
say,
talk
yeah,
about.
being able to sit with their own dysregulation, you know, because sometimes, I guess, just with anxiety in general, sports are not, sometimes as parents are trying to help, sometimes they may be unknowingly reinforcing avoidance and giving the message that this is really bad, that you're feeling bad, rather than it's okay to feel bad at these
Exactly.
times
It's
and getting
acceptance.
related.
Yeah. Right. We know, right, that accepting anxiety and not fighting it and, is really, really helpful. And so normalizing, every athlete feels it is part of the deal. And so when the kid's not finishing breakfast, the parents aren't just getting all upset about it and to just, try to meet them where they are. And it's a big, that's a game changer in terms of the energy of the home and so on,
Can you speak to your, you mentioned or alluded to a couple times of the changes you've seen over the last 25 years? And I'd love to, if you have anything that you could share about differences that you've noticed. You know, I was working with one family where I think the kid was like in fourth grade, and they were like he can't even start soccer now because all these other kids have been doing it for years and have had like one-on-one coaching. And especially in our area, there's a lot of people that will get very intensely into the sports and you know, advance the kids. I'd be curious about your thoughts on what you've noticed has changed over time and any of those influences.
Yeah, it's interesting. The biggest thing I'd say about it is what I dealt with many years ago, 25 years ago, fear of failure. One example, it was early, 98, I think, or something. But a tennis player was, lost a game. It was the first game of the match, and he's throwing his racket, and I was new into the whole thing, and I'm by the way, I had a temper as a kid playing tennis, and so I understand it. But I asked him, what were you thinking, when you threw your racket? And he said, I was worried my ranking would drop. And I said, well, what if that happened? And he said, well, I wouldn't get into a good college. And I stayed with him, and then what? Downward arrow,
Yeah,
excuse me.
exactly, downward
Right.
arrow.
Right. Yeah. And then, well, then I wouldn't get a good job if I, didn't get into good college. And I stayed with them, and then anything left, I thought it was over, but no, I'd probably be homeless, I'll be homeless. Now that was an isolated, but that the level of anxiety and fear and consequences and what are people going to say if I win or lose and, parents, friends, coaches. It's become more pervasive. It's become and it's become almost normal in a bad way. Like it's in society and youth sports that this is like even kids, it's like they're hijacked. I talk to them and it's just normal. Like my UTR in tennis, there's a ranking in UTR. I need this UTR, and the parent, it's just more, it's not an exception. People weren't maybe seeking out sports psychology, certainly were not the way they are now, but it's just more like a language and a way of being and a acceptance of this pressure cooker is what it is. And
And like more focus on rankings and so on, rather than just kind of enjoying the sport and focus on excelling versus or is it more, I guess maybe that one example you're giving was maybe not a majority of the kids, but now there's a more of a majority that are catastrophizing on every move and how it's going to negatively
exactly.
affect their future.
Exactly. And it's just more common, it's deeper. And the focusing on skill development, what I teach is a mastery mindset, right? Process, because the fundamental challenge problem is that the one thing we don't control if we're going to win or lose is the very thing everybody's worried about and thinking about, if this and if that, right? The what ifs. And it's the one, it's the, you don't, you could have the best game of your life, and you still lose. So I try to really train families, kids, to create intentions and new metrics. Basically, I'm trying to create a new metric system of focusing on the things you have control over, obviously, right? And to be, focused, a little more focused, sustaining it, or refocus, to play a little looser, to commit to what they've trained and not back off. And I call it, permission to miss. Give yourself permission to miss, which really resonates with athletes, that, and to give themselves that feeling and experience what that's like. But a new metric system juxtaposed to this, are we going to win? And what if we don't,
Rather than like pass fail, there's maybe some other things that they can be focused on that they're achieving, like more the process necessarily than the outcome.
100%, which is now in 2025 significantly more challenging to move the needle on. Takes longer, and you have to be really, really clear about what you're doing to hold this system long enough to get the kind of movement, because we have so many conflicting voices about, and in the media, what the kids see is Steph Curry and, having this incredible game, and, these amazing athletes, which is 2% of all athletes make it professionally. Less than that, actually. Mostly it's less than 1%, but tennis is 2%. But they're being treated, kids are being sort of, this experience is being treated like everyone's going pro.
It's a lot
So
of pressure.
that allure and is again more commonplace now because of social media, and that's where we're getting
Interesting.
crushed. Yeah, the
I
great experiment.
was listening to an economics podcast about, I think it was minor league baseball players kind of basically forming groups, and whoever, if one of them made it, they would all share in some of the income from that in a way of almost like diversifying because odds are so low. And that way kind of pooling together their resources.
Well, now, just to piggyback real quick, Keith, on that, is now we have athletes being paid to go to college, paid for, right? So there's a, now we've upped the ante on this whole thing.
Now that they can get income and money for the rights of their, the work that they're doing or being used in advertising or games or so on, like video games.
And it's a, they get paid to play for the college, right? So that's an, and as a tennis player, it probably costs 400 grand now to get your kid from 10 to 18, maybe half a million dollars,
Definitely.
to hire the people and do the thing. Tennis is particularly expensive, right? It's another level, but
Sure.
you got pitching coaches now and the whole thing. But it, you know, think about it. And then so college is, so it's kind of a wash. A lot of even if they get to D1,
Yeah.
now being paid is a that percentage you're getting paid. Okay, now you're sort of in the, you know, in the winning column, I guess, financially, but it costs a lot to
Well,
get
not to mention just even the
there.
time parents are taking off to take the kids and,
Good
oftentimes
point.
during working hours and so on, which I think there's probably also a socioeconomic kind of split in who is able to be involved at these high levels with the sports and the time commitments.
Yeah, the sadness, isn't it, that sports, music, sports, the arts is such an opportunity to learn these amazing life skills. The pressure and the team building and
Yeah.
for a lifetime of relationships, which many do have, but this path that is so becomes so stressful, which could be so enriching for everybody. For and that's again why this I just like I have to write a book that, because a lot of it's checklisty and do this and
Yeah.
do that, but I think we need to call attention to this. That's what I think we need to call attention to this and teach people, teach them. And I think people are going to continually be more open to it because they're suffering. Families are suffering a lot.
Yeah, and teaching them what? Like
Tools
those tools and skills.
and how to communicate and validate, you know, some of the motivation interviewing and, you know, teaching mindfulness and helping them learn what reframing really is and how to do it and becoming
Definitely.
aware, frankly, right?
Yeah.
Just teaching awareness and that give them hope because there is a way. There are ways and things that we can teach and they can learn to help them a
Yeah.
lot.
Build that resilience too.
That's
Yeah,
it.
and one thing you were mentioning earlier, you were saying about like kind of one measure of like, kind of what the person's working on or success or so on is if they were kind of following whatever, I guess, program or strategy that they were trying to do rather than maybe falling back. And then you were saying kind of the giving the permission to miss. Were those two connected, or were you meaning like somebody having all their training going in and trying to stick with that during the game rather than maybe like kind of falling back to old habits, in those moments and dropping off what they're maybe trying to work on and as they improve in their strategy or their technique or so on.
Right. So what you're suggesting, yeah, that they lose the, you know, the intentions that they, these metrics, these intentions that they go in and then they fall back, absolutely, you know, typically, certainly in the beginning,
Yeah.
they fall back into the playing safe and worry and all that. And so it's the permission to miss and continuing to, you know, deepen that awareness and commitment and holding that up. And while they have the new metrics, placing, it's not, it's, you can't. Kids are good. They want to win. The kids want to win,
Of course.
but if we can just balance the scale a little more, where the process and the skills and the commitment to those skills they've been learning matches, and we can reduce this perfectionistic,
Yes.
you know, pattern. Now we're the needle's moving, right? Permission to miss in metrics, intentionality, we're moving the needle.
And putting those together. Yeah. Yeah,
Yeah.
interesting with the permission to miss too. It almost makes me think of, almost like exposure therapy, like actually sitting with the discomfort of having missed or so on. I don't know if that's just if it's just more of a mental kind of aspect of a cognitive level of permission to miss, or also, kind of feeling the discomfort and kind of riding that wave of missing, or so on. Is
Yeah,
there?
no, that's exposure and simulation is an aspect, right, of performance enhancement and helping coaches and players, athletes to do drills that put them in situations trying to close out a match and, you know, having, you know, a few seconds left and they and trying to put that pressure on them and use the tools while they're, and you can never simulate a game
Of course.
exactly, but you can create structure to simulate.
Yeah.
And that, so yeah, exposure is really important, so they can, but because what they do inevitably is try to not miss, right?
Yeah, of
Which
course.
makes it worse. So kids double faulting over and over, they're getting stuck, and we need to get them to commit and be, give themselves that permission and feel it, and let them see the anxiety wave drop, feel it drop.
Yeah,
They're,
definitely.
they get they're into the avoidance pattern, right? So then it's they get stuck in that, right?
Yeah,
Yeah,
exactly.
exposure's helpful.
Definitely. And do you also involve visualization? I feel like oftentimes, like, kind of visualizing success or visualizing yourself going through it is something that I often, attribute to more kind of that performance coaching or so on. I don't know if that's something that is, yeah.
Yeah, visualization is a great tool, and the best athletes do it naturally. If you ask them, do you visualize, they just laugh, like, I mean, all the time, they're picturing the shot. And I used to, as a tennis player, I don't know what you know about my background there, and
Yeah, no, yeah.
we can maybe hit on that, and if you'd like, but maybe
Yeah, no,
interested
actually, why
in,
don't you share that? Yeah, because you do have a background.
yeah, I mean, but what that point about, I think you're bringing up, what was that point
Oh,
again?
it's about visualization.
Yeah. So visualization, the perfectionism, interestingly, comes in a lot with kids. So when I have them visualize, and I do meditation with them and a little visualization and in their context of their sport, and, when they do it on their own, often they say, oh, I see myself failing, missing. And so that perfectionism shows up quite a lot in the visualization. So we kind of work through that a bit. Giving, and that's exposure in and of itself. So
Yes,
having them be
exactly.
okay with, that's okay. Like, just stay with that. And then, let's see if, without forcing it, we can get to the feeling of being loose and being focused, et cetera. So yeah, but that's interesting how that comes up a lot. But I absolutely use visualization pre-match, pre-game, 3 minutes, 5 minutes, to see themselves, performing those metrics. So it's not about only winning. Some like to see the winning, themselves winning, but it's more about the metrics and committing to those things. So, yeah, as far as my background, so I played junior tennis, and I went to a tennis academy at 12 when my parents sent me to a, I said I wanted to be a pro tennis player, and at 12, and they, 3 weeks later, I was on a plane down to the Nick Bollettieri Tennis Academy, which is now the IMG Academy, and baseball, football, they have all the sports now, which is a whole incredible thing. I was there in the second year that it was ever there, and lived in a motel with four other kids and from around the world. There were 60 of us. Anyway, I did that, and then I played junior tennis and, all the nationals, and went on to play college, UCSB, UC Santa Barbara. Played there, and I did well. I got better and better. I was kind of a late bloomer, and then I went on to play professionally for a couple years, 2 years. Got world rankings in singles and doubles. But I wasn't making a living at it. So but then yeah, and then I moved to Germany and play, because I got a coaching job in Germany, and I coached tennis and played for a club, which was really great. But that coaching tennis wasn't quite it for me, and I was journaling a lot, and I thought, it was a moment in 1995. I was picking up balls on the court with these junior players, and I'm like, I can't do this. Like, this is not a life career here. But then I thought, well, what about psychology? What about sports psychology? It dawned on me, and that's when I came back here in '95 to go to graduate school and so forth. And then the depth of it, and the my interest in the family systems, and just beyond just performance enhancement, which was really interesting at the time. But both, I really, and I saw it, so I just. I ended up doing both clinical and specialized in sports psychology, but that was my path. And then I think that kind of the interesting story, if you will, is that I then, 12 years after stopping professional tennis, I went back and played and was playing the best tennis of my life. And I became number one in the world in my age group in the 35s. And I was playing players in the top 100 in the world and going three sets with them at 35, 36 years old. In playing in a big tournament down in San Jose, SAP Open. I'm walking off the street. It's a funny story, but I won't, maybe another time. But so this sort of this role as a married family therapist, and then I'm a player and I'm in the big tournament, and it's just it's a it was it's been an interesting sort of
Yeah,
talk
kind of
changing the
moving back
champion.
and forth and between and bringing it together. And I'm assuming, but I'm guessing, right, all this work that you were doing in helping other people with performance coaching and so on came to fruition in going back and playing yourself again.
Meaning using the tools and
Yeah,
such,
exactly.
100%. Like so, so what happened was, I experienced this other state, this other dimension of focus and a feeling of freedom and gratitude. Frankly, gratitude was, I think, the first. It's interesting. I don't, anecdotally, like. In 1996 or so, Christopher Reeves fell off his horse and paralyzed Superman. Superman paralyzed. I don't know. It just hit me, the juxtaposition of that. And I guess I just started to tap into gratitude and how we can all take things for granted and winning and losing and all of that. And will I win? And I, what will people, all this stuff. And I just was able to drop into this state and started playing at a different level. I mean, completely different level. And I'm like, wow, this is interesting. This works. And I just got really fascinated even more applying the mastery mindset and process and focus and being able to change the channel and so
I
forth.
imagine it's almost like transcending beyond just the minutia of, and that being so important to, right, kind of the larger aspects and gratitude and so on.
And you still want to win. So
Yeah, of course.
you see, so that, because a lot of people talk, oh, process versus outcome. It's no, it's, it's meaningful and fun and to play like that and feel that control and mastery. And guess what? You win more with less worry and effort. So it's just getting people to understand and experience this. And then the needle really moves quickly once they
Yeah,
this themselves.
it's hard to teach that. It's like that kind of acceptance, confidence, kind of like letting go while still having the mastery or the locus of control.
Yeah, it is. It's really like, but if you can get, you don't have to do the whole thing. If you can move the ball enough where they can take it and do it, run with the ball for a little bit and experience it. Now you're off and running and you can have that conversation and deepen it. So you don't, you just need the
Like you can
bridge.
have that taste of it or that moment of it to be able to build upon.
Definitely. And then they know you're not convincing them or, dancing, doing the dance and hoping they felt it because they really used the correct diaphragmatic breath. They decided to, all right, I'll go all in on this thing for a week. And they do, and then they play well, feels different, they win. Now you got a customer, right?
Well, and it sounds like too that it's such a great aspect because one, there is a drive, especially at these levels of competition to have any type of edge. So I imagine, there's people approaching you to also just get an extra edge, by mastering their own psychology or so on. But at the same time, also, right, there's those mental health benefits of actually making things more fulfilling. And thus also kind of despite whatever their motives for getting into it is, whether to get an extra edge or to relieve suffering or so on, it kind of all helps in either way.
Definitely, definitely.
Any last pieces that you think would be really important for listeners to know, different therapists that maybe, aren't sports psychologists or so on, or any kind of things that they might be interested in learning more about, or takeaways for working with their own, athlete clients or so on?
I think about I was asked the question the other day for an interview about, if there's one tool or one thing you would sort of sum up what the most valuable tool, and it's an interesting thing. I couldn't give her just one. I gave her three, but and it was the mastery mindset and really working with that, the permission to miss. And then the focusing dimensions, really understanding helping kids recognize that they can shift their focus. Part of that is as we know, I mean, in adolescence in particular, young athletes, young kids, the mind reading trap, as we know in CBT, is such a huge one. They don't have an identity yet. They're forming it. They're borrowing other kids and parents and coaches' opinion of them, and they're so vulnerable, right? We know that. And so I just feel like giving kids a chance to really, when I say play on their own terms more and make choices and assert themselves with their parents. I try to really help empower the kids. So anything we can do to give the kids permission slip to assert themselves with their parents a little bit in a right way, but starting to take more ownership and not be such a victim, if you will.
Like having a
So
voice or having some, again, back to that agency.
agency is huge, right? But I think that those are if you can move the needle in those areas, that's pretty helpful. These tools, there are quite a few tools. But certainly borrowing ACT is great, and CBT is always a playground for us. We need to be there, but there's some other boxes too that we can integrate,
And I love with ACT, the acceptance commitment therapy, just this idea, right? The harder we're fighting it, sometimes the worse it's getting, like quicksand. And so often I'm trying to get rid of that anxiety or trying to have that control is what becomes part of the problem. And so being able to recognize that and accept that, right, part of these struggles are within in the dynamic of what they're working on, allows for some letting go and being present.
And that may be the hardest the biggest challenge
Exactly.
we all have, right, as therapists, to in our roles, to help kids accept what they don't want, what people we don't want instinctively, especially now with the social media and the pressure to accept that you had a bad game and you made a mistake that cost the team, and it's devastating. The kids' worlds blow up inside for a bit. They recover, but yeah, helping them, that's the part that we were challenged with because of this level of expectation and perfectionism, as you know.
Definitely. Well, this is wonderful. And congratulations on the book coming out. We'll definitely link to it. Sounds like there's some wonderful aspects in there that would be really helpful for both therapists as well as clients. Really appreciate your time. Thanks so much, Jeff.
Thank you, Keith. It's been a pleasure.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today. If you'd like to receive continuing education credits for the podcast you just listened to, please go to therapyonthecuttingedge.com and click on the link for CE. Our podcast is brought to you by the Institute for the Advancement of Psychotherapy, where we provide trainings for therapists in evidence-based models through live and online workshops, on-demand workshops, consultation groups, and online one-way mirror trainings. To learn more about our trainings and treatment for children, adolescents, families, couples, and individual adults with our licensed experienced therapists in person in the Bay Area or throughout California online, and our employment opportunities, go to sfiap.com. To learn more about our associateships and psych assistantships and low-fee treatment through our nonprofit, Bay Area Community Counseling, and Family Institute of Berkeley, go to sf-bacc.org and familyinstituteofberkeley.com. If you'd like to support therapy for those in financial need and training in evidence-based treatments, you can donate by going to BACC's website at sf-bacc.org. BACC is a 501c3 nonprofit, so all donations are tax deductible. Also, we really appreciate your feedback. If you have something you're interested in, something that's on the cutting edge of the field of psychotherapy, and you think therapists out there should know about it, send us an email. We're always looking for advancements in the field of psychotherapy to create lasting change for our clients.